This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents When Never Comes by Barbara Davis, performed by Shannon McManus. To Tom, who married me anyway, we've only just begun. Prologue, Monk's Corner, South Carolina, August 19, 1986. The room is dark, but not quite still. A threadbare curtain breathes in and out at the window, shuddering in the sticky Carolina heat. Outside, the hum of night things fills up the quiet, a chorus of moist throats and raspy wings calling through the torn screen. In the bed beneath the window, a girl in a pink cotton nightgown writhes amid tangled sheets. She is a lovely child, raven-haired and pale, a fringe of sooty lashes lying uneasily against her cheeks. Her whimpers turn to tears, turn to wails, turn to shrieks. She is awake, but not awake, flailing one moment, rigid the next, stalked by a terror she can neither see nor name. The dreams have come again, her almost nightly companions. But no one is coming to comfort her tonight. Mama has passed out again on the bathroom floor. 1. Clear Harbor, Maine, November 19th, 2016. The first ring came with the same throat-thickening panic all 2 a.m. phone calls produce. Disorientation, dread, the certainty that something, somewhere, is terribly wrong. Christine shot up with a gasp, grabbing for the phone on the bedside table. Hello?
Mrs. Ludlow?
Yes?
Christine Ludlow?
Yes. Who's calling?
Mrs. Ludlow, this is Sergeant Stanley with the Clear Harbor Police. I apologize for the call, but we've been knocking for some time now. We need to speak with you.
Police? Her pulse ticked up a notch, the skin on the back of her neck prickling with the old familiar warning. What's happened? What's wrong? The voice on the other end of the phone was polite, but strained.
We'd prefer to speak in person.
A moment later, she was pulling back the front door, staring at two uniformed police officers. What is it? Why are you here?
I'm afraid it's your husband, ma'am. There's been an accident. His car skidded off a bridge and into Echo Bay.
Christine's chest seemed to seize. Where is he? Is he all right? What hospital have they taken him to?
Your husband isn't in the hospital, Mrs. Ludlow. He didn't survive the accident. I'm afraid we're going to need a next of kin to come down and identify his body.
The silence spooled out as the words penetrated. Stephen's body. Echo Bay.
We'd be happy to drive you,
the sergeant continued, his voice full of polite sympathy. It wasn't his first time knocking on a door in the middle of the night, Christine realized dully. How many wives, mothers, lovers, and friends had gotten the visit she was getting now? It took a moment for the sergeant's offer to penetrate. No, she replied, feeling strangely detached, as if watching the scene from a long way off. The last thing she wanted at that moment was a ride in the back of a police car. Thank you. I can drive myself. The sergeant nodded.
We'll wait while you get dressed, then, and you can follow us back to the station.
Christine nodded, trying to wrap her head around what had happened, and the reality of what came next. Best-selling crime novelist Stephen Ludlow was dead, and she needed to go identify his body. But first, she needed to get dressed. Christine felt the ground tilt as she stepped into the lobby of the Clear Harbor Police Station, the scuffed black-and-white floor tiles, the unforgiving fluorescent glare, the nauseating aroma of burned coffee and stale cigarette smoke,
reminded her queasily of another night, another calamity a lifetime ago. She shook it off. Deal with the calamity in front of you. If life had taught her anything, it had taught her that. Sergeant Stanley stepped away to speak to the officer at the front desk, then turned back with an awkward smile and pointed to a row of blue plastic chairs along the wall.
You can have a seat if you like. We've called to have someone escort you down.
Moments later, the stainless steel elevator doors opened. Christine was startled to see a familiar figure step into the lobby. Daniel Connolly had been, a close friend of Stephen's, a drinking companion, and a regular at his Friday night card games. But he was a homicide detective, and Stephen had died in a car accident. What was he doing here at 3 in the morning?
Christine.
He took both her hands in his. They were hot and slightly sticky.
I'm so sorry. When they realized it was Stephen, they called me. They thought it might be easier if I was here to explain things.
She frowned. Explain things? It was an odd way to put it. A cold, blunt way. She pulled her hands free, trying not to be obvious as she wiped her palms on her jacket. Thank you, Detective, for coming out at this hour.
Please, call me Danny.
He was thick-set and beefy, with full, ruddy cheeks and a head of wiry gray hair. They had met more than a few times, and then only briefly. But she'd never been able to understand Stephen's fondness for the man, beyond the fact that, as a homicide detective, he'd been an invaluable research contact, always happy to pass along juicy case details in exchange for a box of Cohiba cigars or a bottle of good single malt.
I guess we should get on with it,
he said grimly.
Are you ready?
Christine nodded. There really wasn't another option when your husband's body was lying on a gurney somewhere, waiting to be identified. She allowed Connolly to take her elbow and steer her toward the elevators, saying nothing as he pushed the button stamped with a well-worn B. The basement, then. Stephen was in the basement. When the doors opened again, Connolly stepped out and turned left, leading her down a white-tiled hall lined with windowless blue doors. He stopped in front of the last door on the right and reached for the knob. A dull buzz filled Christine's head as she stared at the engraved metal plate. Morgue. Connolly threw her a glance.
You all right?
The words seemed to come from a long way off, as if they'd been spoken from the bottom of a very deep well. This couldn't be happening. Couldn't be real. And yet the look on Connolly's face told her it was very real indeed. Pulling in a lungful of air, she counted to 3 and nodded. She was aware of Connolly's hand at the small of her back as her feet began to move, and wondered if the light but steady pressure was meant to propel her forward or to keep her from keeling over backward. No doubt he'd seen his share of fainters. She experienced a moment of surprise as she stepped through the door. She'd been bracing for unpleasant odors, blood, decay, formalin. But there was only the faint aroma of bleach in the air. It was a small mercy, but a mercy nonetheless. She was determined to keep her eyes moving as Connolly steered her deeper into the room, absorbing it all in one terrible sweep. A high-ceilinged, sterile-looking space with suspended fluorescence and battleship-gray floors. She avoided the strategically placed drains built into the floor, unwilling to contemplate their purpose, shifting her gaze instead to the trough-style sinks along the back wall. The wall on her right was lined with numbered doors, square stainless steel doors in tidy rows, equipped with heavy metal hatches. One of those doors would belong to Stephen soon. She turned away, trying to banish the thought, but everywhere she looked, there was a fresh reminder of what she was here to do. And then she saw it. A gurney draped with a plain white sheet. Her breath caught at the sight of it, the air in the room seeming to go cold. A man in a dingy lab coat stood on the other side of the gurney.
his back to them as he scribbled on a clipboard. As if sensing their approach, he turned. He was young, mid-twenties, with a pocked complexion and thick, smudgy glasses. He stood there blank-faced, as if waiting for some signal. Connolly laid a hand on her arm.
Are you ready?
Christine nodded, but couldn't find her voice. Her eyes slid to the attendant.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Without expression or fanfare, the attendant reached over to pull back the sheet. Christine braced herself as she forced her eyes to the body on the gurney. The waxy face a bloodless blue-white, slack in death, but eerily unmarred. He wasn't wearing his jacket, and his top shirt buttons were open, his tie loose and askew. Yes, it was him. Had his face been a ruin, she would still have known him. There was no mistaking the Robert Mitchum-style cleft in his chin. And yet, there was a jarring strangeness, too. The movie star good looks were flaccid now and slightly bloated, leaving behind only a blank husk of the man she'd married 8 years ago. The iconic charm and carefully polished charisma that had made Stephen Ludlow an international media darling had been extinguished. Yes, she said hoarsely, then cleared her throat. Yes, it's Stephen. She was relieved when the attendant dragged the sheet back into place, but angled her body away from the gurney just the same. What happens now?
The ME will determine cause of death, Connolly explained. Though with the icy condition of the bridge, I think we can safely assume the crash will be ruled an accident. Death caused by either trauma from the crash itself or by drowning.
He paused, letting the words sink in.
I'm sorry to be blunt, but there is really no nice way to say it.
She blinked heavily at him.
No,
I suppose not. Do I just go home now?
There are papers you'll need to sign. But we were wondering...
He paused to clear his throat, his eyes skittering away briefly.
We were hoping you'd be able to help us with something else.
Christine felt the first icy pangs of uneasiness. Something about the change in his voice, his sudden reluctance to look her in the eye, made her scalp prickle. Help you with what? Connolly looked down at his shoes and sighed.
It's a rather delicate matter, actually. One, I wish to hell I could spare you. But the fact is...
The words fell away. His eyes straying again, this time to a gurney on the opposite side of the room.
We need your help, Christine.
Uneasiness morphed into dread as her gaze slid along with Connolly's to the nondescript white mound on the second gurney. He was shifting from foot to foot now, his hands thrust deep in his pockets.
Stevens wasn't the only body we pulled from his car, he said gruffly. Unfortunately, no identification was found for the second victim. We were hoping...
The attendant was there suddenly, his blue latex gloves hovering expectantly over the sheet. Connolly gave a curt nod. No one spoke as the sheet came away, and in the silence, Christine became aware of a clock ticking somewhere, heavy, hollow, like a pulse. And then she found herself staring at a woman. She was a ghastly shade of white, her platinum hair fanned out from her head in a snarled, sodden halo. There was a gash on her forehead and a sickening depression along her right temple. Her eyes were open and glazed, a piercing shade of violet, with fixed, bottomless pupils. She was also naked from the waist up. Her breasts so full and round, they couldn't possibly have been formed by nature. Christine found herself unable to look away. A prostitute? A one-night stand? A casual dalliance? Or something more? And if so, how much more? Connolly cleared his throat.
Do you have any idea?
No.
I know this is hard, Christine, but please take your time. Look closely.
I don't need to look closely. I don't know who she is or what she was doing in my husband's car.
Her voice broke suddenly, and for an instant, she thought about lunging at the detective.
This is why you're here. Because of her. Because you were Stephen's friend, and they thought you'd be able to get a name out of me. That's what you meant when you said you were here to explain things. When you said things, you meant her.
Christine, I know this doesn't look good. I can't even imagine what's going through your mind right now. But we don't know what this means. We shouldn't jump to conclusions.
She isn't wearing a shirt, Detective.
And there might be a perfectly valid explanation for that. Maybe when the divers pulled her out of the car, her clothes...
He let the words dangle, the look on his face making it clear he'd drawn the same conclusion she had. The only conclusion that could be drawn when a half-nude woman was pulled from a man's car in the middle of the night.
Connolly shifted uneasily, his beefy shoulders bunched.
Was he... Do you know if he was... seeing anyone?
Christine glared at him, astonished.
You're asking if I knew my husband was having an affair?
Like that's something we'd discuss over dinner? I'm sorry. I thought maybe women had a sense about these things. Women's intuition, or whatever you call it.
She eyed him coldly. Connolly ran a hand through his thatch of gray hair.
Look, I'm just trying to do my job. I've got 2 years left in homicide, and I'm out. Until then, I do what they tell me. When they realized who they'd pulled out of the bay, they asked me to come down and talk to you. We've got a Jane Doe whose family's going to want to know why she didn't come home tonight, and we can't tell them until we know who she is.
Christine bristled at the inference that it was somehow her duty to help identify the half-nude woman.
I'm afraid I can't help you, Detective. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to go home. You said there were some papers I needed to sign.
Connolly stepped away briefly, returning a moment later with a clipboard Ryan had been scribbling on. He pointed to a line at the bottom, then flipped the page, pointing to two additional lines. Christine signed without reading and pushed the clipboard back into his hands.
Are we finished?
For now, yes. You'll get a copy of the report when the ME's finished his examination, and someone will call to let you know when you can come down and collect his things.
Christine stared at him blankly.
His things?
Keys, wallet, cell phone.
Right. His things.
She turned toward the door, fumbling in her pocket for her own keys.
Here,
Connolly said.
Let me walk you out.
Thanks, no. I can find my way.
She knew she should thank him for coming down in the middle of the night, but somehow she couldn't manage it. She was almost to the door when he stopped her.
I'm sorry about this, Christine. Truly sorry. Stephen was a friend, but he was also a highly visible public figure. The media is going to want to know what happened. I'll do what I can to keep the details quiet, but I can't guarantee anything.
Christine nodded, then turned back toward the door, not sure whether she should feel gratitude or dread. 2. It was 4:30 when Christine finally navigated the Range Rover back through the security gate and into the garage. For a time, she couldn't say how long. She simply sat there, with the door open and the engine running. The sun would be up soon, the beginning of a new day. There would be people to call, details to handle. But she was too numb to think about any of that now. Instead, she sat in the eerie glow of the dashboard lights, wondering how her carefully ordered marriage had ended in such a spectacular derailment. She had married an icon, a catch by any woman's standards. Not bad for a girl from the wrong side of the tracks. Stephen Ludlow. Even his name had conjured respect, and if he'd seen it as his job to smooth out her rough edges and make her over into a proper society wife. It was a small price to pay for the stability she had craved. But who was she now that Stephen was gone? A widow suddenly adrift, unmoored from a life that had never quite been hers. A widow. How was that even possible? Marriage had never been part of her plan. Far from it, in fact. She'd grown up hard and fast, the way most children of addicts did, and had learned a thing or two along the way. At 10, she learned that no address was permanent. At 12, that no promise was sacred. And at 16, that there was no such thing as safe. There were other lessons, too. Lessons that were still etched in her mind. And her flesh. She dragged back her coat sleeve and stared at the trio of scars on her wrist, shiny and pale, like a constellation of tiny moons. Her badge of survival. Yes, she'd learned a thing or two growing up, including what happened when you trusted the wrong people. And then she met Stephen. He was handsome and charming, a rising star in the publishing world. But even more appealing was the fact that he hadn't batted an eye when she informed him, quite emphatically, that children weren't part of her long-term plans. In fact, he'd seemed pleased. He was career-minded, and so was she. At least, that was the excuse she'd given. They were married 6 months later. It wasn't a storybook marriage by any means, but then she'd never really bought into the whole happily ever after myth. Like most whirlwind romances, the early days had been about newness and chemistry. But over time, their relationship had evolved into a kind of arm's-length alliance, symbiotic and safe, steady, or so she thought. She glanced at the clock on the dash, nearly 5. How is it possible that so much could change in the space of 3 hours? And yet it had. Everything she knew, or thought she knew, about her life and her marriage had suddenly been turned on its ear. She closed her eyes, letting her head fall back against the headrest, waiting for the tears to come. Instead, her head filled with images. A ghost-white face caved in on one side, violet eyes staring at nothing. Who was she? But she was too numb to ponder that question right now, too sick and too weary to wade through scenarios that all seemed to point to the same terrible conclusion. Exhausted, she dragged her purse from the passenger seat and slid from behind the wheel. There was a moment of disorientation as she stepped into the kitchen, as if she had accidentally wandered into someone else's home. She was used to the house being empty. For the last few years, Stephen had rarely been home for more than a week at a stretch. There was always somewhere he needed to be, another book tour, lecture, or talk show appearance. But this emptiness felt different. As if, with Stephen gone, the house had lost some of its life force. But then, it had always been Stephen's house. He'd become obsessed with the idea of living in the house Warner Brothers had used to shoot the ending of Victims' Rights, his third novel, and the first in a series of grittier-than-life box office smashes. So obsessed that he'd made an offer on the place without bothering to consult her. That had been 4 years ago, about the time she started to realize what a small role she actually played in her own marriage. She collapsed onto the sofa and unwound her scarf. The sun would be up soon. The morning news hitting the airwaves, newspapers landing on doorsteps. There were calls she needed to make. Stephen's agent, their lawyer, the insurance company. At least there were no family members to contact. Like her, Stephen had been an only child, and both his parents were dead. His father of a heart attack while Stephen was still in school. His mother of a cerebral hemorrhage 2 years ago. It was a terrible thing to be grateful for. But knowing what she did, she couldn't imagine having to tell his parents about the accident, or face them at his funeral. She was in the process of unlacing her boots when the kitchen phone rang. By the time she got to it, The call had gone to voicemail. She waited for the recorded message to play out, then picked up when she heard Stephen's agent on the other end. I'm here, Gary.
Tell me it's a mistake, Christine. Tell me what I just heard on the news isn't true.
It isn't a mistake. Stephen's dead.
What the hell happened?
The police said there was ice on the bridge. His car skidded into Echo Bay.
Jesus. I'm sorry, Christine. I can't believe it. I thought he was on his way to New York for a signing at the Strand. What the hell was he doing up near Echo Bay?
Christine's grip tightened on the phone. She wasn't going there. Not now, not ever, if she could help it. He must have finished early and was trying to beat the weather home. Does it matter?
No, I suppose it doesn't. Are you sure there hasn't been some kind of mistake, though? Sometimes the police...
I saw him, Gary. They made me go down and identify his body.
Jesus God, I'm sorry. That must have been awful.
It was.
There are things...
He broke off. There was a brief stretch of silence before he went on.
Look, I'm not trying to be a bastard or anything. Stephen was a friend. But there are things we're going to need to talk about. Details.
The medical examiner has to finish up before they can release Stephen's body. They didn't think it would be more than a few days. I suppose I could... There was an awkward clearing of his throat as Gary cut her off.
I wasn't talking about funeral arrangements, Christine. I meant contractual details, how things work when an author dies. Part of the advance for his next book has been paid out, and now...
Now he'll never finish it.
Yes.
I don't care about any of that, Gary. I never have. You know that. Just take care of it. Whatever needs to be done, do it.
All right,
he said, willing, for the moment at least, to let the subject drop.
We'll talk again when you've had some time. I didn't mean to get into this today. I just wanted you to be aware that there needs to be a conversation at some point. Not that I have anything to tell you right now. I haven't spoken to anyone at Lloyd and Griffin yet. I'm sure they're still digesting the news like the rest of us, though I do expect my phone to start ringing any minute. My guess is yours will too. Tragedies sell, and the media is going to eat this one up with a spoon, Christine. Just remember, you don't have to talk to anyone until you're ready. Or ever, really. Your grief isn't anyone's business but yours. In the meantime, I'll review the language in Stephen's contract about editorial control, and of course the royalties, which, as you know, are fairly sizable. I do know he named you as his literary executor.
Christine was too fuzzy to digest what he was saying. I don't know what that means.
It means you decide how Stephen's work is handled going forward. Copyright issues, movie rights, that sort of thing. But it's nothing you need to worry about right now. Right now, you need to take care of yourself and get through this. If there's anything you need, anything at all, I want you to pick up the phone. I mean it, Christine. Anything.
She was numb as she ended the call. She had only digested about half of what Gary said, and wasn't sure she cared about the other half. The truth was, she'd never had much of a grasp on how and when Stephen got paid. It had been hard enough when there were only 3 books. Now there were 11, not counting A Fatal Franchise, which was set to release in 8 weeks. The truth was, she had no idea how much money Stephen had. The statements arrived, the funds went into the bank, the bills got paid. As far as Stephen was concerned, that was all she needed to know. And she'd been largely okay with that. She'd never been comfortable talking about money, perhaps because, as a freelance editor, she earned so little in comparison. She didn't even know the name of their broker. The thought of what lay ahead left her exhausted as she mounted the stairs to the bedroom she and Stephen had shared. She desperately needed a shower, but the effort required to strip off her clothes was more than she could muster. Instead, She settled for brushing her teeth and washing her face. She was foraging in the medicine chest for the bottle of ibuprofen when the phone rang again. The number wasn't one she recognized. She let the call go to voicemail, cringing as a reporter for the Boston Globe rambled through polite but curt condolences before finally getting around to business and asking for an interview. The message no sooner ended than the phone rang again. The Portland Press Herald at this time, followed by the Times, the Mirror, and the Dallas Morning News. She let them all go to voicemail. The messages were largely the same, a pretense at sympathy, followed by a request for an interview with a widow. When the phone rang a fifth time, she turned off the ringer, did the same with a phone in the kitchen, then shut down her cell for good measure. Gary was right. Her grief, and anything else she might be feeling, was no one's business but her own. Out of habit, she wandered back down to the kitchen and made coffee, then roamed the house with her mug, forgetting to sip as she lingered over things she and Stephen had collected over the years, a hand-blown glass bowl they had discovered in a tiny shop in Rockport, a lamp made of driftwood designed by an artist from Portsmouth, the Thomas Arvid oil painting that hung in the dining room, purchased on their honeymoon. How long ago it seemed now. 8 years. How had they slipped by so quickly? And how had she not noticed that things were changing? That Stephen was changing? Or maybe she'd just pretended not to notice. Determined to shake the thought, she reached for the remote. The screen flared to life, a pair of talking heads behind the WGME news desk, with a bright red breaking news banner crawling across the bottom. Author Stephen Ludlow dies in car crash. It was bad enough seeing the words, but when Stephen's face flashed up on the screen, the headshot from the back cover of his last book, she sagged onto the sofa and turned up the sound.
Police say Ludlow's car skidded off the Echo Bay Bridge and submerged in the chilly waters below. The cause of the accident is still under investigation, but it's believed that the ice on the bridge was to blame for the crash. Divers recovered the body just after midnight. Ludlow is best known for his Craig Childress detective novels, several of which have been made into successful action films. Ludlow resided in Clear Harbor, Maine, and is survived by his wife, Christine. The couple had been married for 8 years and had no children.
No, Christine said, clicking off the set when coverage shifted to an apartment fire in Portland. No children. As if it was anyone's business. There had been questions, of course. Awkward, intrusive questions she never quite knew how to answer. No children yet? How long have you been trying? Are you considering in vitro? Because if you are, there is a wonderful doctor at the new Women's Center in Portland who is having fabulous results. She never understood why people, women especially, assumed that every woman on the planet felt a bone-deep need to clone themselves for posterity. If they knew what she knew, had seen what she'd seen, they'd know there were worse things than being childless, like having a child you weren't equipped to care for and scarring it for life. She rose, carrying her coffee mug to the kitchen, then stood staring out the window over the sink. It had begun to snow, lazy flakes drifting down like small white wings. It was the third week of November, a little early for serious snow even in Maine, which meant it wasn't likely to hang around. Still, the sight of it accumulating on the deck was depressing. Stephen had loved the New England winters, or rather, he had loved the idea of them, of being holed up over the long, frigid months, pecking away in a study with tall windows that overlooked the sea. It was the image he liked, the way he wanted the world to see him. But then, for Stephen, everything had been about image. His career, the house, even their marriage had been carefully crafted to resemble something from the pages of a glossy magazine, as if real life had never quite been enough for him. Perhaps that explained the blonde in the morgue. And yet, there was no proof that he'd actually been having an affair. Maybe Connolly was right. Maybe it wasn't what it looked like. Either way, the detective had kept his word. There had been no mention of the Jane Doe on the news. The sound of a car door slamming suddenly caught her attention. Traffic on Pulpit Rock Road was rare enough in season, locals mostly, in their Volvos and Subarus. But after Labor Day, when Clear Harbor emptied for the season, cars were virtually non-existent. Though it wouldn't be the first time a tourist had ignored the private road sign and ventured out onto the point. Curious, she padded to the living room and peered through the curtains, troubled to see that a handful of TV news trucks had gathered outside the front gates, looking like something from a bad sci-fi movie with their giant satellite dish antennas. When in God's name had that happened? 3. Clear Harbor, Maine, November 26, 2016. It had taken only a handful of days for Stephen's death to go from local tragedy to national obsession, and now, a week later, Christine couldn't turn on the TV without seeing some rehashed version of how the literary community had been tragically deprived of its brightest star, and if that wasn't enough, the number of media trucks outside the gate had been growing exponentially and were now accompanied by a throng of reporters peering through the fence. She had yet to brave the mob. In fact, with the exception of a phone call to Dorsey and Sons to make arrangements for Stephen's memorial, she hadn't braved anything at all, choosing to remain cloistered, licking her wounds without the intrusion of phones, newspapers, or the internet. But today, she would have to leave her sanctuary. Today was Stephen's memorial. She had expected to feel something like closure when she woke this morning, or at least the promise of closure. But all she felt was dread. She had managed to get through the morning, skipping breakfast to rake through her closet for something to wear to the service. Now, as she descended the stairs, she caught her reflection in the mirror at the end of the gallery. A dry-eyed ghost, wearing the suit she had purchased 2 years ago for her mother-in-law's funeral. She dreaded the day ahead, queasy at the thought of facing Stephen's friends, playing the grieving widow, when the truth was, she was quietly fuming. She hadn't let herself be angry at first, passing those early few days in a kind of haze. It seemed wrong somehow to be angry with someone who had just died. But then, out of nowhere, she had been struck with a mix of fury and curiosity, propelling her to Stephen's study in search of the usual red flags, suspicious hotel bills, clandestine emails, lingerie receipts. Initially, she had come up empty. But then she noticed a pattern of monthly auto drafts paid to Star Properties LTD. The name didn't ring any bells. For all she knew, Star Properties was one of the publicity firms Stephen used to book events and draft press releases. But there were also regular transfers to an account labeled Travel. $4,000, drafted on the 5th of every month. Not that either was proof of an affair. It was entirely possible the payments were legitimate business expenses, or that they were related to Stephen's investments. But her intuition told her they were not. In the end, it was a photograph that provided confirmation. She'd been sitting at Stephen's desk, exhausted after her search, thinking, as she stared at a collection of photos on a nearby bookshelf, how little Stephen had aged over the years, when she noticed that, in one of the shots, his eyes were angled toward a small group of onlookers. And there she was, at the edge of the frame, wearing skin-tight jeans and 4-inch heels, her heavily made-up eyes slanting boldly back at Stephen. It was the intimacy of the look that knocked the breath out of Christine. A private moment captured by chance, and for a moment, she found herself trying to remember if there had ever been a time when she and Stephen had looked at each other that way. If there was, She couldn't remember it. Was that Stephen's fault or hers? She couldn't say. But she felt the thought lodge itself in some dark corner of her mind, like a pebble in a shoe that could be ignored for a while, but would eventually have to be dealt with. The case clock on the mantle chimed softly, reminding Christine that she had somewhere to be. But as she grabbed her purse from the kitchen counter, her eyes slid to the phone. She'd been checking her messages all week, hoping to hear back from Connolly, but so far there'd been nothing. 11 new messages awaited her when she pushed the button. Reporters, colleagues, even offers of sympathy from neighbors who'd heard the news way down in Sarasota or wherever they went when the leaves began to fall. One by one, she deleted them, but paused when a familiar baritone filled the kitchen.
Christine, it's Gary. Call me when you get this.
She hit save and moved on, in no mood to deal with Stephen's agent. To her dismay, the message that followed was also from Gary. His voice sounded oddly strained.
It's me again. Please call me back so I know you're all right.
Was she all right? Christine blew out a sigh. She appreciated him checking on her, but it was hard to say what constituted all right these days. She jabbed the button again. This time Gary's tone bordered on urgent.
Christine, Jesus, where the hell are you? I've been trying to reach you for 2 days now, and all I get is this damn machine. Call me as soon as you get this. We need to talk.
She rolled her eyes as she checked her watch. She had time for only one phone call before she had to leave, and it wasn't going to be about book advances and movie rights. She needed, no, she deserved, to at least know the name of the woman who had died with her husband. She dialed Connolly's number from memory. After 4 failed attempts, she knew it by heart. Not that she expected to catch him at his desk. He was always out on some investigation when she called, or in the middle of an interview. Today proved no different. The woman who answered the phone informed her briskly that Detective Connolly was out of the office and promptly shunted her off to his voicemail. She left another message, for what it was worth, the 5th by her count, and hung up. Maybe it was just coincidence that he was never available. But part of her wondered if he was purposely dodging her calls. Perhaps he'd learned more than he wanted to, and was trying to spare her the truth. If so, he was wasting his time. That ship had sailed. Christine checked the time once more and picked up her purse. She had a husband to memorialize. But first, she was going to have to navigate her way through the mob of reporters at the gate. Her palms felt sticky as she backed the Rover out of the garage and down the driveway, then reached for the remote clipped to the driver's side visor. She thought Stephen was just being paranoid when he'd insisted on installing a perimeter fence and security gates to keep out crazed fans and curiosity seekers, he'd explained. But now she was grateful. Though she doubted he had foreseen a time when the curiosity seekers would turn out to be members of the press, clamoring for a glimpse of his widow. The furor began the moment the gates began to slide back. Reporters with notepads and cell phone cameras held aloft, squeezing to the opening like a colony of fire ants. Apparently, they'd seen the memorial notice in the Herald and were hoping to grab a quote as she left the house. The Rover lurched backward as she goosed the accelerator. She held her breath as she continued down the drive, eyes focused straight ahead as she inched past the gaggle of leering faces. Just a few more yards and she'd be home free. She was about to breathe a sigh of relief when a meaty fist pounded on the driver's side window. She hit the brakes with a strangled yelp, glancing up in time to see a man in a red L.L. Bean parka plaster a newspaper against the glass. Suddenly, horribly, she understood. The reporters weren't here for a quote about Stephen's memorial. They were here to get her reaction to the grisly image staring back from the front page of the Examiner. The empty eyes of Stephen's Jane Doe. The Naked and the Dead. Mystery Blonde Pulled from Stephen Ludlow's Car. The earth shifted, As Christine stared at the headline, a slow, shuddering quake that only she seemed to notice. As if sensing her dismay, the reporter's questions ratcheted up, swelling from hungry clamor to full-blown frenzy. Frantic, she cast about for some route of escape, only to find herself hopelessly cut off from both the road and the open garage door. She was going to have to make a run for it. They rushed her the instant her foot touched the driveway, like a pack of gulls after a toddler with a French fry. There was no scurrying for the front door, no scurrying anywhere. Instead, she was forced to elbow her way through the crush, eyes fixed desperately on the front door. If she could just get inside and bolt herself in, she'd be safe. But the reporters knew it too, and collectively wedged themselves between her and the front steps, so that her only choice was to brave the gauntlet. Lowering her head, she plunged into the fray, muscling past faces that seemed to blur into a single greedy entity bent on blocking her path. She was nearly sobbing by the time she reached the front door, so shaken, she almost dropped her house key. She had lost her scarf somewhere in the press, and the top button on her jacket was hanging by a thread, but she didn't care. All she cared about was reaching sanctuary.
"Mrs. Ludlow?"
A woman's voice suddenly rose above the din.
"Do you know the woman they pulled from your husband's car the night he died, and were they involved sexually?"
A momentary hush fell as the mob waited for a response. When none came, the questions resumed.
"Can you comment on the fact that she wasn't wearing any clothes when they pulled her from the car?"
"The police are still referring to the woman as Jane Doe. Can you tell us her name?"
"Do you know how long the relationship has been going on?"
"Have there been other women, or was she the first?"
Christine nearly wept as her house key slid home. By the time she pushed inside and shot the deadbolt, she was gulping back tears. She had no idea how long she stood there, too shaken to make her legs move. But suddenly she knew she was going to be sick. Panicked, she dropped her purse and scrambled for the kitchen, where she retched over the sink until she was limp-limbed and quaking all over. She'd never been comfortable in crowds, but a mob of reporters hurling questions about her dead husband's mistress was an entirely new level of discomfort. After splashing her face and pulling a bottle of water from the refrigerator, she wandered back to the living room, careful to steer clear of the windows. Her purse was still on the floor. She bent to pick it up, then froze when she spotted a rumpled copy of The Examiner inside. No doubt the work of one of the reporters in the scrum. Her hands trembled as she smoothed out the wrinkles. The photo had clearly been taken at the morgue. But by whom? And how had it ended up on the front page of a national tabloid? Jane Doe's face stared back at her in grainy black and white, her once vivid violet eyes reduced to a nondescript shade of gray. It took all the strength she had to keep turning pages, until she located the actual story. A grisly two-page spread, along with another splashy headline. "Can you identify this woman?" There were four additional photos scattered throughout the article, each more disturbing than the last. The first was an enlarged shot and very blurry, and yet there was no mistaking the crescent-shaped birthmark on the woman's right breast, highlighted now with a circle of bright red ink. The next two shots were of her face, one taken straight on, the other in profile. The last photo was a shot of her lying on the gurney, the polished toes of her right foot peeking obscenely from the sheet draped over the lower half of her body. The story itself was no better, full of dark implications and gruesome innuendo. Though given the evidence, it was hard to draw any conclusion but the obvious one. Christine stared at the blackout boxes, strategically placed over the woman's breasts, certain their purpose had less to do with journalistic discretion than with heightening curiosity. Everything about the piece, the explicit photos, the celebrity name, the untimely death of a beautiful blonde, bore the distinct whiff of erotic tragedy, conjuring names like Mansfield and Monroe, as had no doubt been intended. Only this blonde had no name. Though it was only a matter of time until the press learned her identity and went digging for the rest of the story. Battling a fresh wave of nausea, she reached for the TV remote and began surfing. It didn't take long, only 3 clicks, to find Stephen's face splashed across the screen. And hers. The picture was from their vacation in Barbados 3 years ago. How had they gotten it? Stephen and Christine Ludlow were married in 2008. The Entertainment Tonight anchor was saying, as a fresh round of photographs appeared on screen. By all accounts, their marriage had been a happy one, but recent developments are raising questions about whether Ludlow might have been romantically involved with a scantily clad woman whose photos have now appeared in several tabloids. No identification was found when divers retrieved her body from Ludlow's car. Authorities tell us the investigation into the woman's identity is ongoing. Ludlow's wife has been unavailable for comment. We'll continue to keep you updated on this story as information becomes available. Christine clicked, then clicked again, running through the list of cable news channels. The story was everywhere. Different talking heads, different photos. But the gist of the coverage was the same. Iconic author dies while cheating on wife with mystery blonde. Only now the story wasn't just about Stephen, or even the Jane Doe. It had become about her, too. In the kitchen, she picked up the phone and punched in the number for the Clear Harbor Police. This time, when the desk sergeant answered, she refused to be handed off to Connolly's voicemail. "No, I do not want to leave a message," she barked irritably. "I've left messages, 5 of them to be precise, for all the good they've done me. So what I need you to do right now is put me on hold and go find him. Don't come back and tell me he's in an interview or out on a case. I'm a case. My dead husband is a case. So unless you want me to come down there and camp out in the lobby, you'll put him on the phone." There was no response, just a curt click, followed by empty silence as she was put on hold. While she waited, she picked up her water bottle and pressed it to her cheek, then her neck, wondering what excuse she'd be given this time. She nearly dropped the phone when Connolly's voice came over the line.
"Christine, I'm sorry. I've been swamped. As I'm sure you've seen, there's been a development."
"Yes, I've seen," she snapped. "I've seen that my driveway is so full of reporters I can't get out to attend my husband's memorial service. I thought you said you could keep things quiet." There was a long pause, then a gravelly rumble as Connolly cleared his throat.
"There was a leak, Christine. It sucks, but it happens. If the brass ever finds out who it was, they'll be fired. But at this point, the genie's out of the bottle."
"The genie's out of the bottle? That's what you have to say to me after a reporter just stuck a half-naked picture of your Jane Doe in my face? That's how I found out about the leak. Not a phone call. A mob of reporters on my front steps."
"I didn't mean it like that, Christine, and I'm sorry, but it all just blew up. The pictures are out there, and the media wants to know what we know."
"And what do you know?" There was another long pause, the sound of a heavy breath being let out slowly.
"Unfortunately, not much more than we did the night of the accident. We got a few tips this morning after the photos broke. We were checking them out. But in cases like this, you tend to get a lot of crackpots. So far, there's nothing concrete. Whoever she was, no one's looking for her. At least not yet."
"So what do I do? I live on a private road, and I can't get out of my house. They're practically camped out on my front porch. I can't even close the front gates."
"I'll send a car around to move them off your property and clear the street. I can't guarantee they won't be back, but for now at least, we can give you a little breathing room."
"And you'll call me when you finally know something?"
"Christine."
His voice was annoyingly paternal.
"Sometimes, the best thing for everyone is to just move on. To remember the good times, instead of dwelling on a lot of unpleasantness. A name isn't going to change anything. Why not leave the police business to us, hmm?
Because we're not talking about police business, Detective. We're talking about my life, my husband, my marriage, my driveway. So please don't condescend to me. The way I see it, a wife's right to know the truth trumps a friend's desire to sweep his poker buddy's indiscretions under the rug. Come to think of it, you didn't seem all that surprised that there was a woman in my husband's car the night he died.
Christine.
You knew, didn't you? Maybe not her name, but you knew there was someone. Another sigh. This one weightier than the last.
I wasn't sure, but I suspected. He'd let a few things slip now and then. Nothing specific, just things. He never mentioned a name, though, and I never pressed him for one.
Of course not. That would be breaking the rules.
Rules?
The Cheaters Club, or whatever you call it? All for one and one for all? Isn't that how it works?
Look, Christine, I know this hasn't been easy for you, especially the way it all went down. But one thing I do know is that Stephen...
Don't, she snapped, cutting him off. Don't you dare say he loved me. That isn't why I called, to have you reassure me that a half-naked woman in my husband's car doesn't mean anything. She means something to me. I think I have the right to at least know her name, and I don't mean by reading it in the tabloids. It's been a week, and honestly, I'm beginning to wonder if you're not dragging your feet on purpose.
What is it you're accusing me of?
The paternal tone was gone, replaced with a gruff wariness. I'm not accusing you of anything. All I want is a name, and the number or address of someone who might be able to tell me what was going on between that woman and my husband.
Look, I don't have the information you want, but even if I did, I couldn't share it with you. Victims have rights, Christine. So do their families. In other words, there are rules, and if we break those rules, we get in trouble. I've put in a whole lot of years here, and put up with a whole lot of crap. At this point, all I want is to get out and spend a few years on a little sailboat down in the Keys. I'm not about to stick my neck out, not even for the wife of a friend. I know that sounds harsh, but I have to look out for myself here. Stephen's death wasn't a homicide, which means I'm not even the guy you should be talking to. If anything, it's a missing persons case. And it's not even that, since no one's filed an actual complaint on her. Either way, it's not my purview. Now, I need to go do my job. I'll make sure they send that patrol car around, but I'm sorry. That's all I can do.
And just like that, Daniel Connolly was gone. Christine was still leaning against the counter, wondering why she'd just been given the brush off, when the phone rang. She pounced on it, hoping Connolly had changed his mind. Instead, it was Dorsey and Sons. In the mayhem, she had forgotten that Stephen's friends and colleagues were at that very moment gathering to pay him tribute, and wondering what had happened to the widow. As it turned out, she needn't have worried. Apparently, the barrage of breaking news had whittled the number of mourners to an awkward handful. But then, that really wasn't surprising. Who in their right mind would want to look her in the eye now, let alone gush about what a great guy she'd married? Using the vaguest language possible, she explained she had been unavoidably detained and wasn't likely to get there anytime soon. Mr. Dorsey, presumably one of the sons, was delicacy itself as he inquired about how best to proceed. In the end, she advised him to cancel the service, but to go ahead with a cremation, which he had agreed to do in tones that could be described only as painfully polite. He hadn't come right out and said so, but she was certain he'd seen the photos. Everyone had by now. Apparently, the old adage was true. The wife really was the last to know. 2 hours later, Christine caught the sharp whoop-whoop of a police siren out in front of the house. She hurried to the living room window, peering out in time to see a Clear Harbor patrol car inching up the crowded drive,
blue lights flashing.
The officer stepped out and began waving his arms, gesturing to the no trespassing.